Welcome back to Hashtag Health. This is the second part of our two-part series on sepsis. In part one, we talked about how despite being a leading cause of global mortality, a large portion of the general public is not aware about sepsis. We spoke to Dr. Leliktovich, a clinician scientist studying sepsis, about what sepsis is, how it presents, and how it is treated. With that foundation in place, in this episode we expand the conversation to a broader discussion about critical illness, trial design, and Dr. Leliktovich's research themes as they relate to sepsis. We ended off the last episode by defining the term syndrome, which is a group of signs and symptoms that tend to occur together and are suggestive of a certain condition. Now, as we'll discuss, classifying constellations of symptoms under the umbrella of a syndrome is useful for several reasons. However, as is pointed out by several publications, the current syndrome-based classification model may not sufficiently capture the full complexity of critical illnesses. And that's where we want to begin this episode's conversation. We asked Dr. Leliktovich to speak to some of the pros and cons of the current syndrome-based framework of critical illness.
Absolutely. That's an excellent question, Jay. And it's a complex question. First of all, the syndromic definition that was first described in 1991 has certainly spurred a lot of good quality research that has allowed us to develop guidelines to enable physicians around the world to develop consistent strategies to treat patients with sepsis. Without these definitions, it would be very difficult to enroll patients with infection to clinical trials because of the fact, as I mentioned, these populations are so heterogeneous. So these syndromic definitions at least allow us to classify patients into severity categories, initially based on the SIRS criteria or the systemic inflammatory response criteria, which included an elevated white blood cell count, an elevated temperature, an elevated respiratory rate, and elevated heart rate. So these were the four criteria that used to be used ubiquitously for sepsis research to enable enrollment in clinical trials. In 2016, these definitions were changed to the sepsis 3 criteria. And now instead of an elevated heart rate, an elevated white blood cell count, an elevated respiratory rate, and an elevated temperature, the criteria changed. And the only thing that really remained was the elevated respiratory rate, and everything else was changed. And now instead of an elevated heart rate, the criteria became a decreased blood pressure, and white blood cell count was dropped, and was substituted for a decreased level in consciousness. So the three criteria that we now use to describe this syndrome for research purposes and to help doctors triage individuals who seem to have sepsis in an emergency department include decreased level of consciousness measured by the Glasgow Coma Scale, decrease in blood pressure, and the increase in respiratory rate that is usually suggestive of an increased level of acidosis as a respiratory compensation for metabolic acidosis. So as you can see, the old and the new definitions are very non-specific, and that's where the syndromic problem comes in, is that even though they both facilitated improvements in or enabled patient enrollment in clinical trials, because of their non-specific nature, there is certainly a lot of unknowns and uncertainties and inappropriately triaged patients who might not have sepsis because these definitions are so not specific.
And to bring this all together now, we asked about what some of the causes are of the heterogeneity in patient presentation and response to treatment.
So sepsis is not unique for heterogeneity. I just want to emphasize that. You know, a lot of syndromes that we study are heterogeneous, whether that's heart attacks or strokes or patients with gastrointestinal bleeds. You know, most of the people we study and provide care for are heterogeneous. The difference with sepsis is that the heterogeneity is not just related to the host. It's also related to the interaction of the host with the microorganisms that cause infection. So I really think that there is a big difference with sepsis and heterogeneity because it is amplified compared to other syndromes in medicine. The heterogeneity that is not unique to sepsis is related to patient age, to patient sex, biological sex and gender. It's also related to comorbidities, individuals who have diabetes, who have cardiovascular disease, who have liver disease, who have cancer. or are immunosuppressed for other reasons usually have a worse clinical outcome. And these are factors that unfortunately are not modifiable. The other branch of heterogeneity comes from the infection. And here the heterogeneity is kind of twofold. One is the organism. The organism can be a bacteria, a virus, a fungus. Within bacteria, there's millions of different organisms that could be, or billions of different organisms that could be culprits, grossly divided into gram-positive, gram-negative infections, multi-drug-resistant infections, viruses that are more prone to attack one organ compared to another, and fungi that are also more difficult to treat because they're more difficult to grow in the laboratory, and they're more difficult to treat because our treatment options are not as expanded as for antibacterial agents for bacteria. The other branch of heterogeneity from with respect to infection comes from the site of infection. So for example, somebody who develops a central nervous system infection with Streptococcus pneumonia will behave completely differently, and their mortality will be completely different from somebody who's infected with Streptococcus pneumoniae that is infecting the lung. Generally speaking, infections of the central nervous systems are much more difficult to treat. Selecting antibacterial agents that cross the blood-brain barrier are more difficult. Making a diagnosis is more difficult because it requires suspicion of involvement of the central nervous system, doing a lumbar puncture, a more invasive procedure. And this, again, as I mentioned, the selection of treatment agents is different. So that's certainly one organ that's associated with worse clinical outcome. And then there's a lot of other organs that might be affected. And that's, you know, as we talked about already, the lung, the gastrointestinal tract, and the urinary tract. And all of them are associated with different risks of mortality, independent of all the other factors I just mentioned. And then one more layer of complexity, in addition to the non-modifiable factors I first mentioned, and then the factors related to infection, are the treatment strategies. And certainly here, we already talked about the non-specific treatments being fluids, intravenous fluids, vasopressors to augment blood pressure, as well as initiating more specific therapy with antibacterial agents. There are other strategies that we offer. Some of them include steroids to minimize the inflammation, but potentially it could be also detrimental to the immune system response. And other novel therapies that have been considered in the last 5 years, especially with the advent of the COVID pandemic and some of the novel agents that we've tested.
The next question we asked was in keeping with the theme of heterogeneity. On one end, you've got the patient demographic and non-modifiable risk factors, and then on the other side, you've got the infection-related causes of heterogeneity, being type of organism and site of infection. We asked about approaches to trial design and what can be altered to address the clinical and biological heterogeneity in patient populations. Things like demographic information can usually be stratified for, but how might that work when considering syndrome definitions? We've talked about how they help with recruiting patients for clinical trials, but don't necessarily account for heterogeneity that exists with the type of organism responsible for the infection, for example. So how might trials be designed to address that cause of heterogeneity?
Oh, great question. I'll use the pandemic as a great example of how trials have really rapidly evolved in critical care. In the context of COVID, one of the easy things that happened is that there was a single source of infection from a single organism to a single site. And that minimized the heterogeneity of patients immensely. The fact that we were able to really rapidly screen for COVID-19, again, minimized our confusion as to what are these patients presenting them with and what are the organisms. So certainly having rapid diagnostics and a rapid way to screen for an organ that's affected by sepsis is a great strategy to limit the heterogeneity and enrich the population for a more homogeneous population. Something else that has been trialed, in addition to diminishing the source of infection and the organism, is diminishing the biological heterogeneity. And over the last 2-3 decades, what has been done is patients' immune system can roughly be estimated by using point-of-care diagnostic tests to potentially stratify individuals into inflammatory categories. strategies that have been used in the past have been you looking at interleukin 6 levels. That was a strategy tested about two decades ago in a trial that looked at a suppressing TNF-alpha presence in circulation of patients with sepsis. TNF-alpha is one of the most inflammatory cytokines that is upregulated or increased in the context of sepsis. And stratifying individuals by an inflammation category can certainly help to target immunological agent administration more homogeneous or appropriately to patients in a more precise way. Procalcitonin is a very non-specific marker. It's also measurable in plasma of patients. And that marker has been used widely and is in use actually in some centers throughout Canada to determine which patients can be de-escalated from medication, such as antibiotics. And in some clinical trials, it has been used to stratify patients into, you know, deciding what antibiotics should be administered, and especially in the context of pneumonia that has previously had some clout, not as widely used in practice, however. So strategies that could enrich populations certainly include biological ways to enrich populations. Other randomized clinical trials have tried to use imaging as a way to stratify patients into categories that be more responsive to a therapy. This has been tried in the context of acute respiratory distress syndrome due to sepsis resulting in acute respiratory distress syndrome, and imaging such as chest x-rays and CT scans to try to more homogeneously provide ventilator care to individuals with either more focal or diffuse level of consolidation on their imaging. So there's whatever strategies used really requires rapid application, because one of the things that we know about critical illness is that the earlier we can intervene, the more likely we are to have a meaningful outcome. So certainly having clinical variables is fantastic, because those clinical variables are present at the time of stratification into trials. But because these clinical variables, as I already mentioned, are so relatively speaking non-specific, having more precise ways to triage patients into precise medical clinical trials is really the mecca of what we're trying to achieve in critical illness. And that really requires more accurate and rapid point of care diagnostic tests to allow us to use biology to potentially stratify patients into clinical trials. And that's certainly an ongoing area of interest and research.
Let's transition to talking about Dr. Lelikdovich's research themes. We asked her to speak to the top contour of how the immune system is regulated in early sepsis and how that progresses.
Gosh, if I could answer that question, I think my career would be finished. You know, one of the really mysterious things that happens during sepsis is that the immune system is differentially regulated in individuals. And what we know is that some patients present with immensely upregulated immunity, and that's usually quantified by the presence of inflammatory cytokines present in their blood or plasma. And some patients don't. However, just because somebody's inflammatory cytokines might be upregulated in the soluble portion of blood or plasma, doesn't necessarily mean that the function of the immune system is correlated to that degree of inflammation. And actually something that we've found in my lab and in other translational biology labs around the world is that the degree of circulating inflammation is actually inversely correlated to the immune function of the individual. And what I mean by that is that the greater the inflammatory profile, the greater the interleukin 6, the TNF-alpha, the interleukin 8 that's circulating in plasma, usually is indicative of an immune system that's on its way to exhaustion. Meaning that if you were to take the immune cells out of the patient's blood at the same time as the cytokines are measured, you would find that these immune cells would be less likely to respond to secondary stimulation with typical antigens or products that we use to stimulate these cells. One of these products is lipopolysaccharide, or LPS, and it's been widely used in all sorts of immunology research in the last 50 years. And my lab and other labs around the world have shown that lipopolysaccharide stimulation of leukocytes, or white blood cells, removed from patients with sepsis differentially respond to lipopolysaccharide. And those that have a lower response to ex vivo stimulation usually progress to more severe infection and usually are at more risk of secondary infections such as ventilator-associated pneumonia, C. difficile infections, central line infections. Therefore, something about their immune system seems to be intrinsically abnormal and damaged or dysregulated. So I would say those are kind of the two easy ways to measure the immune dysregulation is plasma cytokines and ex vivo stimulation of leukocytes. Some of the other more recent and contemporary ways that we can also study the immune dysregulation involves much more time and cannot really be done at the bedside. And that's understanding the transcriptional profile of immune cells. So we use RNA sequencing that both captures the bulk population of leukocytes in blood, as well as single cell RNA sequencing from dedicated bodily sites, such as the bronchoalveolar lavage fluid that tries to understand the immune profile of immune cells in the lung in patients who might be presenting with sepsis due to pneumonia. And that really tries to stratify patients into inflammatory profiles that now could be potentially explained by the differential expression of 20,000 different genes. So that analysis obviously is not at prime times of trying to understand patients at the bedside, but it certainly informs us about what potential pathways and genes might be differentially regulated. And then we work backwards to bring it back to the bedside by studying these specific molecules in the plasma of individuals and see whether there are meaningful differences that we might detect at the bedside that won't require months of data processing and analysis.
Next, we asked, how might incorporating biology into classification in the way you've mentioned, through point-of-care diagnostics, for example, improve diagnosis, prognosis, and treatment options?
Well, thank you very much for asking that. Again, a very complex answer here. You know, in order to do this type of research, I really want to highlight the fact that it can't be done by one investigator. It requires a team of, you know, like-minded, passionate translational biologists. And certainly there is a group of us around the world who's trying to answer this question, because in order to try to identify a single marker that would be the equivalent of the cardiac troponin of a myocardial infarction, we need huge patient populations, and it's unlikely that any single individual or their research will be able to uncover this. So, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do to decrease heterogeneity, understand it better, is to use large patient cohorts to understand how patterns might be, patterns after adjusting for all the covariates we talked about earlier that are non-modifiable might help us understand the biology of critical illness and of sepsis. Because one of the things that's emerging is that some of the dysregulated pathways are not necessarily unique to sepsis, and that by the time somebody is so severely ill that they require organ support, the pathways that are dysregulated in sepsis are not necessarily that different from the pathways that are dysregulated in acute respiratory distress syndrome, or patients potentially coming with severe trauma that involves multiple organs and causes multi-organ failure. So what multiple clinicians around the world are trying to establish is pipelines of analysis that might help us limit the heterogeneity and understand shared pathways between different syndromes, that instead of targeting specific syndromes, we might be able to target dysregulated pathways. And that really leads to the next phase of understanding critical illness, is how can we potentially treat a dysregulated pathway as opposed to a syndrome? And how can we actually diagnose that in a rapid fashion? So as you can imagine, the multi-omic analysis requires time. And the solution to all this that all of us are aiming for is a diagnostic test that could be applied at the bedside that could quickly and rapidly triage patients. Now, such a test does not exist right now. We do not have a magical bullet yet for sepsis. There are certainly interesting candidates or groups of candidates that individuals are starting, or, you know, groups around the world are starting to focus on. We have recently published on a molecule circulating in plasma called soluble TREM, or a triggering receptor expressed on monocytes. This is a receptor that is usually cleaved from the surface of monocytes, which is one of the white blood cells circulating in a whole blood of patients during infection. And when monocytes are activated and become dysregulated, TREM tends to be cleaved off the surface of monocytes, and the higher expression in plasma tends to be a more specific marker than some of the things we've previously used to define infections, such as CRP or C-reactive protein, a very non-specific inflammatory marker. Having said that, usually a single marker is probably never going to be enough. Having 1,000 markers might be incredibly specific, but is not very friendly to use at the bedside. So what we're trying to, as a global community, develop is a reasonable panel of markers, maybe 2 or 3 easily detectable markers that together might be more specific in the context of a dysregulated immune response in the context of sepsis compared to a dysregulated immune response in the context of a myocardial infarction. So when somebody presents with sepsis, what we'd be aiming to improve is the pathway that's dysregulated, as opposed to, you know, providing bulk care with fluids, pressors, antibiotics, also offering therapy to support the biology that's abnormal in that individual.
One of the last questions we asked was about looking forward. 10 years from now, or on an extended time frame, what might the treatment of sepsis or critical illness at large look like? It's been mentioned already that we don't at the moment have a rapid diagnostic test or a panel of specific markers to turn to. We asked if anything else comes to mind.
Yeah. So I think in the next 10 years, I'm not sure how much is going to change yet. I know these are changes that take many years to establish. You know, one of the things you asked me earlier about was clinical trials. You know, novel opportunity that emerged is the development of adaptive randomized clinical trials. And these trials are actually being embedded into clinical practice. And they're speeding up the way that we're doing clinical trials. The traditional way that we did clinical trials was to test therapy A versus placebo. Now we're able to test therapy A, B, C, D, E versus placebo. And as therapy A, B, C, D becomes either beneficial or detrimental, the therapies that are becoming detrimental are taking out of the clinical trial, and the ones that are working preferentially are increasingly being administered. Some of these clinical trials are embedded into clinical practice, which means that it naturally allows the clinical trial to evolve into changes in practice. So certainly some of these have already been launched in Canada. We still don't know a lot about them. You know, we're learning about the process of how adaptive trials are going to work. How are they going to change practice? Some of the ethics related to conducting them. But certainly I envision that through the use of these novel ways to conduct clinical trials, we might also change the way we provide care to our patients. And as a consequence, you know, potentially change the trajectory of the trajectory of sepsis, you know, prognosis. The other, hopefully, change that we'll see in the next decade is how we define sepsis. And there is a big push to integrate not only non-specific variables, but some more specific biological determinants of infection, and whether that might be more related to the bacteria itself or virus, or potentially the host and the host's response. As you know, at the very beginning, I mentioned that sepsis really is the dysregulated response to infection. And how do we actually capture that without only, or in addition to only non-specific factors like respiratory rate and decreased level of consciousness, will be important. So I do think that in the next decade, that's going to be a shift, is the ability to diagnose sepsis more accurately. And as a consequence, with more accurate definitions will come more accurate, more precise way to target therapies. So, and as a consequence, the prognosis will also improve. So I do have a big hope for biology to be incorporated. And I do feel that just with the evidence that we have to date, that biology is an important factor in the continuum of care, that will be, you know, make its way to the forefront of sepsis care.
And just before we wrap up, we asked if there's anything that we haven't covered in the conversation thus far that Dr. Lelikdovich would like to speak to.
You know, I think one of the things that we've been discussing is some complex concepts related to sepsis. And I think one thing that we need to realize is that these complex concepts are not understood by the majority of Canadians. Sepsis is... anybody could be at risk of sepsis, but most Canadians have never heard the term sepsis. And if they have, they understand it very poorly. Most individuals don't understand that it's a severe infection that has gone awry, that the major contributor to it tends to be the immune system. You know, and without a public understanding of it, it's going to be really difficult for anything that we might want to do specifically, because most individuals present very late. And the later you present with any disease, the more difficult it is to resuscitate and provide appropriate care. So I think one important goal for clinicians, for the Canadian healthcare system in the next decade will also be to increase awareness in the patient, and not just patient population, but in the Canadian population as to what sepsis is, what can cause it, what are the consequences, and why it is important to present to care early. And I think that will probably have one of the biggest impacts in a sepsis survival.
That concludes this episode of Hashtag Health and our two-part series on sepsis. Before we go, we'd like to point you to a couple of valuable resources on sepsis education that you can find in the episode description. We would also like to thank Dr. Lelik Dobich for taking the time to be on the show. Thank you all for listening as well. And to be the first to hear about our new episodes, please follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Hashtag Health Podcast. See you next time.